Now, when were you brought up by the A's?
1942 season, I was with Wilmington, Delaware. In the middle of the season, I was brought up to Connie Mack.
Who was the manager there?
The manager at the time? Tom Oliver, I believe.
Rebel Tom Oliver,
Rebel
the former outfielder.
Right.
I see. And you were going well when you were brought up?
Oh, yes.
How did you feel about making it to the major leagues? I realize you started in 1940 and this was your third year, but, you know, the day you found out you were going up, how did you feel?
Oh, I was excited because I was coming home.
Uh-huh.
Philadelphia's my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my people around here used to come down to ballpark. Come down to Wilmington, Delaware to see me pitch.
Very good. You pitched in six major league games, so one in 1942 and five in 1943. Are you sorry that you didn't get more of a chance to show what you could do?
Yes, I am sorry. Connie Mack liked big guys, and I just happened to be one of the small ones.
Mm-hmm. You told me something about having a nifty relief stint one day against the Senators, and you thought that after that you might get more of a chance, and it didn't happen?
Yeah, I was very fortunate that day. I came in the second inning, two outs, and threw a one-hitter the rest of the ball game. The score was 5-0 when I came in, 5-0 when I came out.
Mm-hmm.
But Connie Mack didn't know that I took 30 minutes batting practice the previous day.
Hmm.
Or the same day.
Jeez, that's something.
It was always batting practice with him.
Mm-hmm. So you pitched a lot of batting practice, but
yeah,
not in the actual
game.
Dave
Keep drew a blister that day, and so I finished up 20 minutes or 30 minutes of batting practice, and second game of the doubleheader, I come in and pitch the 7 1/3 innings relief.
Holy smokes. So you pitched the equivalent of, what, about 11 or 12 innings of baseball?
It would be a little more than that with 30 minutes of batting practice.
It didn't hurt your arm, did it?
No, it didn't hurt.
Uh-huh.
Earl Brooker had told Mr. Mack, he said, no one told him that I pitched batting practice that day.
That's something. What were your impressions of Connie Mack? How did you feel about him as a man, as a manager? Of course, he was getting up in years by that time.
Well, at that time, he was getting senile.
Mm-hmm.
And he would evaluate a man. If he didn't know you by sight, he would know you by your voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him for a raise one day, and he said, young man, you ought to be thankful you're here. I turned around and walked back down the steps and got dressed.
Mm-hmm.
Brooker said, how'd you make out? And I said, how's everybody make out that asked him for a raise?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted him to sell me, and he wouldn't sell me. Kept me the whole year.
Mm-hmm.
The Yankees wanted to buy me. Raleigh Hemsley talked to me and said he won't get rid of you. Washington wanted me. He wouldn't get rid of me.
Hmm.
And he sold me to Baltimore.
Hmm. When did you get sold to Baltimore?
In the wintertime after the 43 season.
Mm-hmm.
Felix Mackowitz, Frankie Scaff, and myself.
All three of you went down.
All three of us went down. And George Stoller was involved in coming to Mr. Mack, and then within a 2 or 3 week period, we had George Stoller back in Baltimore.
Hmm. Of all the ace players you associated with, who impressed you the most and why?
Oh, the one I liked on the club was Dick Siebert.
Mm-hmm.
Very polite, and he would go out of his way to teach you and help you.
Hmm.
And he was quite a first baseman and hitter.
Anyone else?
Hal Wagner. I first met Frankie Hayes the year before, and I couldn't... He never liked rookies.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't go out of his way to help you or teach you. Bob Swift was good.
So Wagner, you enjoyed pitching to Wagner and
Wagner.
Swift?
Yeah, Wagner.
Mm-hmm.
Wagner caught me.
I see. And he went out of his way to help you and
yes,
to go over the hitters.
And Bob
with
Swift
you.
Was the same way. Hal and I got together pretty good.
I see. Anyone else?
Well, Bob Johnson was my idol, even when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
And I, in turn, pitched against Bob that day. He was in the Washington lineup.
Mm-hmm.
And we always got along pretty good.
Fine. And I guess he was with the A's when you came
yes,
up in 42.
Yes, he was.
And before he went to Washington.
He would come over and introduce himself to you.
Really?
Yes. Frankie Hayes would do that.
Hmm. Had you known Johnson as a youngster? Had you ever met him?
Never met him before.
Mm-hmm.
Never met him until I first came up. I was on the other side. I didn't forget who I was next to. Lumen Harris and Roger Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And he walked over and introduced himself to me, and I was quite flabbergasted because he was quite a hitter.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Sam, in 1944, the Orioles had kind of a Cinderella season and wound up winning the Junior World Series against Louisville, and I'd just like to have your comments on that season. You don't have to give me a complete rundown on it unless you want to, but just some of the highlights.
One of the highlights of the season was after the ballpark burned down, we went on the road. We had new equipment, breaking in shoes, getting blisters, new gloves. Everything was lost in the fire. And we just started to gel.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a young kid on at short, no more than 16, 17 years old,
Kenny Braun.
Mm-hmm. We had the youngest two catchers in the league, Sherman Lawler and Stockhausen.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, Lou Kahn came to us. And then we got Red Embry, George Hooks, Colique up in Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
and Tommy Thomas was the man that done everything to the club.
Mm-hmm.
Stan Benjamin was quite a leader. Scaff started to hit. Joe Melendick, he came in as a substitute for Mackiewicz, and it turned out that everything was fine.
Very good. Evaluate Thomas as a manager.
Thomas, to me, was more like a man sitting in your own living room talking to you.
Hmm.
He would tell you to do this, do that, be emphatic about it. And if he knew you had a bad night the night before, it would be right down the bullpen. How do you feel? You couldn't tell the man you felt bad. If he needed you for two or three innings, you'd do it for the man. That's
mm-hmm.
the kind of a man he was. You'd never turn him down.
Mm-hmm.
And I never turned him down. Never had a sore arm pitching. And if I'd done something wrong, he would tell me. Just like, don't go to Sweeney's. That's where we went to get a glass of beer. It's the truth.
Yes.
The truth. And if you stayed out too late, he knew it.
Mm-hmm. Did the whole team get along with him, or just the pitcher?
Everyone got along with him. He was a good front man, and I played for quite a few managers. He is the best I played for.
Fine. Okay, now, when did you go into the Army? I know that you didn't play ball in 45.
I went in the Army and I wasn't home too long. November.
Mm-hmm.
We at the Little World Series, I come home, stayed in Baltimore for a while, and 2 days later, I was inducted to service.
Would you describe your service career for me, where you went and what you did?
I can't tell you certain things. I could tell you, but I don't know if you were right or not.
Well, no, I mean just the outline.
Yeah, well.
You know, where you went, where you wound up.
Well, it was Camp Croft, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm. Camp Croft?
Camp Croft.
C-R-O-F-T?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Clem Levine was there at Peterman.
Mm-hmm.
And my first wife at the time gave birth to a child, and I wanted to get home with a weekend pass.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't allow weekend passes for the recruits.
Mm-hmm.
So the captain gave me a couple blank passes to go home and be back by 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
That evening, Sunday, I didn't get back till the following morning.
Mm-hmm.
Class me they were.
Mm-hmm.
Then they put me in a guardhouse.
Mm-hmm.
So the one who was guarding me picking up trash was Al Tiedemann, third baseman from Baltimore, substitute
mm-hmm.
third baseman. So they asked me if I wanted to stay there as cadre and play ball. I said, no, I'd like train with these guys, send me overseas with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I went.
Yeah. Now this was to the Philippines?
Right.
Direct?
Philippines, direct to the Philippines. We started for Italy and they rerouted us and sent us to the Philippines.
Mm-hmm.
And from the Philippines we went to Korea, and I went on TDY orders for 90 days, Army Athletic Staff School,
mm-hmm.
and I run a ball club over there, and they put me in special services.
This was in Korea?
Yeah, out of the infantry.
Mm-hmm.
Put me in special services, give me an easy job.
Were there any other major leaguers on that club?
No. Milo Candini was with Washington, I run into him there,
mm-hmm.
and I run the ball club.
I see. So you managed and pitched?
Managed and pitched.
Okay.
Every day. maybe two days, sometimes two games a day.
I see.
Morning and afternoon, 4 o'clock.
You told me last winter that you lost something in the service. You lost some of your pitching ability. I wonder if you'd tell me why and also go into that story about being candid with Tommy Thomas when you came back.
Yeah, well, I come back out of the service and went back down. And the second day I was there, done some running, I come in and pitched the ninth inning. I think it was against Newark. I threw 9 pitches and struck out 3 hitters. And then I lost a little bit in the service pitching every day.
Mm-hmm.
Some days I pitched 2 games. And
so you really did more than you should have done, or would have done under normal conditions.
Not through anything of being a sore arm or anything. You just lose a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like they evaluate by inches.
Mm-hmm.
And them inches could be a mile.
Mm-hmm.
And normally, if the mile was there, you'd get it by the hitter, and if you lost by the mile, then you would get tattooed.
I see.
So, got to the point that I told Thomas, I said, I could stick around and help you, but I don't want to be excess baggage.
Mm-hmm. And when is this now? This is 46,
this was
46. Right? What month?
Right after the end of the season, when I had told him the truth.
Right, so you were in the Army 2 full years.
Yeah.
You missed 46.
Going almost 2 years.
Okay.
I got out in August of 46.
Okay, but didn't play ball in 46.
No.
Okay.
And 47, I went down, I helped Herb Brett down in Danville, stayed there a few months, then I come home, and I went down to Richmond for that month that I told you about, and he beat me out of the $500 for the one day.
Mm-hmm.
And I give up on it. What I should have done was went on pirate.
Mm-hmm.
I've probably been retired for some reason.
So basically your last season in organized baseball was 1947?
47.
I see.
1947.
There's one other question I'd like to ask you, Sam, and that is, I want to go into some of the players in that 44 Baltimore club. You've commented to me before about how good Sherman Lawler was for his age. Do you want to describe him for me, what he was like as a 20-year-old? I mean, could you tell at that time that he'd go on to become an excellent major league catcher?
Well, at that time, he was only 18 years old.
Oh, really? Oh.
He was only 18.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to us and that's all that Tommy had.
Mm-hmm.
And he had this young boy, I think, Milt Stockhausen.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had Lou Kahn come in. Lou was a couple years in organized baseball.
Mm-hmm.
But Sherman Lawler, right off, started hitting the ball, done everything right, and was a nice, clean-living boy with it.
Mm-hmm.
And he just went into greater things.
I see. How did Kenny Braun, the 17-year-old shortstop, make out? Was he over his head, or could he handle Triple-A ball, or what was then Double-A?
Well, that was Triple-A.
Mm-hmm.
That was Triple-A, International League. This little kid looked like he just come out of a high school class.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to call him the Weasel. Anything that was hit either side, the kid would come up with it and throw him out.
Mm-hmm.
He'd always lose his hat, but mm-hmm. he made the plays. And Frankie Scamp had helped him a lot, and Blas Menaco.
Mm-hmm.
Played on either side of him, third and second.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid hit the ball in the pinches. They didn't hit him far.
Mm-hmm.
But the kid won quite a few ball games for us.
It's amazing. The regular shortstop that year was Fred Pfeiffer.
Fred Pfeiffer.
And Kenny Braun was the backup. He played in about 35 games, and both of them hit in the 170s.
That's right.
Thomas and just had them in there for their defensive ability.
He just had them. He knew which club to play him against.
Uh-huh.
Pfeiffer would go good against Newark and Buffalo.
Yeah.
And Kenny Braun would do terrific against Jersey City and Rochester. And he knew just what to do.
And you won with 2 shortstops that hit in the 170s.
Right.
Would you like to comment on any other of the Oriole players that year that stand out?
Oh,
of course, Howie
sure.
Moss was a fine ball player.
Howie Moss could hit the heck out of a baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some pitchers that came in. Red Embry, Cleveland sent him to us. He came out of the Michigan State League. George Hooks.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had a guy that name was Stan West, little burly fella, always pitched.
Mm-hmm.
We had one of the best relievers around that the Phillies had, junk ball Johnny Pagani.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Pagani. And anytime Tommy called on someone, nobody turned him down. Went in, they'd done the job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how close-knit this ball club was.
That's fine. One final question. What are your impressions of baseball today as opposed to when you played?
Well, right now, today it's a much faster game with the AstroTurf.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think 60% of the players playing now could play on natural grass. That'd make more errors.
Mm-hmm.
And just like I told you before about the batting helmets and the batting gloves,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure that their average would be down.
Mm-hmm.
Because pitchers that come a little close to them, they'd be, have a tendency of being a little afraid.
Mm-hmm.
Where with the helmet on, they have a little protection. They can stay in there longer.
Mm-hmm.
And the baseball nowadays are souped up pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And the one that I, in a little World Series when we played Louisville, was a Goldsmith 97.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that ball nowadays compared to that.
Hmm.
That just jumps off the bat.
Hmm. So you had a lively ball in the International League,
yes.
Despite the shortage
ball,
of materials.
American Association, Southern Association had the Goldsmith. We didn't.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
our
obviously.
Ball was no comparison to that.
Oh, you had a rather dead ball?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We were supposed to be down in Louisville, and they were supposed to run through us in a little World Series, and we beat them 4 in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And they were amazed when they come to our park and seen them 58,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
I think they got scared.
Hmm.
We beat them 4 in a row.
Hmm.
And they were the ones who were supposed to dominate us.
Yeah.
But they were surprised. They went down there and they started using that 97. And they seen some of the balls that were hit out of the ballpark in batting practice by Lawler and Benjamin and Moss and even Makowicz.
Mm-hmm. So you used International League balls when you played in Baltimore,
right.
And Southern Association
down there.
American Association,
right.
Balls in Louisville.
And they were amazed how many balls were hit out of there,
mm-hmm.
by that lineup in batting practice.
Fine.
44 and 45, along with the Philadelphia Phillies of 1946. Hopefully, I have filled in all of the items of importance that you wished to know. And on your question of number one, in 1942, the Los Angeles Angels was managed by Arnold Jigger Stats, S-T-A-T-Z. Stats also played some games in 1942 as our center fielder. Our 1942 team had Gilly Campbell and Harry Land and Al Todd catching, Eddie Wakus and Wimpy Quinn at first base. But Quinn was sent out. Roy Hughes, was at second, and Elmer Mowry, a reserve infielder. Bill Schuster was at shortstop, and Eddie Mayo at third base. And in the outfield, we had Peanuts Lowry in left field, Barney Olson in center field, too, and Johnny Moore in right field. The pitching department consisted of Ray Prim, Ken Raffensperger, Don Osborne, Pete Mowry, Paul Gearman, Red Lynn, Red Adams, Jess Flores, Jody Phipps, and Orrin Baker. These players won seven consecutive exhibition games against the parent Chicago team in spring training. Roy Hughes was a Tony Perez to the Los Angeles Angels and or a Joe Morgan in performance with the Houston ball club. Just team morale, a great individual effort, and a complete team execution, a performance. Successful game-winning achievements occurred at the moment or proper game time to become victorious. All team players really enjoyed a profession they loved and performed their duties, responsibilities, with character. And these tributes gained team success, a desire for victory. Jimmy Wilson, your number two question, Jimmy Wilson was concrete on player acceptance and performance. In his mind, to lose consecutive games would not alter his player and lineup personnel. Poor philosophy and adjustment, and do it my way. But Charlie Grimm was jovial, relaxed, good judgment of everyday lineup players, straightaway ball playing was Grimm's theory. And play it hard and to do your best professional ability. Grimm recognized slumps of players, injuries, and welcomed player constructive information for team success. Wilson would not mention a kind greeting. Wilson could have a roster as at present positions of a kind of this kind. First base, say, Hank Greenberg, who hit 58 homers. Second base, Dave Johnson of Atlanta, who hit 43 homers. Third base, Eddie Matthews of Milwaukee, who hit 47 homers. Shortstop, Ernie Banks of the Cubs, who hit 47 homers. Left field, Ralph Kiner of Pittsburgh, who hit 54 homers. Center fielder, Hack Wilson of the Cubs, hit 56 homers. In right field, Roger Maris of the Yankees, hit 61 homers. And catching Roy Campanella of Brooklyn, who hit 41 homers. And the pitcher with Wes Farrell of the Cleveland Indians, who hit 9 homers. And he would not know who to play or where. I think that'll take care of Wilson. Now, your number three question with Lenny Morello. Morello did have playing periods when he would tighten up and an unnatural playing form, and also his hitting was affected. Morello was fortunate to be a Jim Gallagher's boy. That's general manager Jim Gallagher of the Cubs. I performed down the stretch end of the season even in the next to the last game of 1945 at Pittsburgh, when we clinched the pennant against Fritz Ostermuller. 3-2, final score. I moved Stan Hack from first base to third with a hit to right center field, and Cabaretta scored Hack with the winning run. My season play enduring our neck-and-neck standing with the Cardinals that year should gain some managerial recognition, although I never thought of any individual achievements at the time, because daily achievements in my uniform on the field was for my team to win, and win any way possible. Morello and I were, and are, good friends. Morello could not steal bases with me, nor hit and run with me. Our par at bat about equal. Batting averages are recorded. Morello had a stronger arm than mine, but not as accurate. Morello could not execute the plays that I did. Morello was a one-position player, and I played several positions and very well. World Series play is the goal for all winning, playing-minded Major League players. This was always my thinking of goal of expectations. I made it and extremely happy of our gainful, victorious performance. Our manager, Charlie Grimm, deserved tremendous credit for success, because he kept we players together and relaxed to perform daily our capabilities. Number four, about Bill Schuster. Bill Schuster and I were teammates for 4 years, 2 years at Los Angeles and 2 years with the Cubs. Schuster would surprise you at any moment in the clubhouse or on the field. If the visiting dugout was on the first base side and Schuster grounded out and was thrown out at first base, he would sit on top of the visiting dugout roof and sometimes climb the backstop screen. His team nickname was Monkey on a String, or Sabu, Sabu the Ape. Red Lynn, one of our pitchers, was touchy, goosey, you know, and Schuster would consistently play pranks on Lynn to get Lynn to swing at or hit objects before Lynn. One night in Brooklyn, after our game, Lynn and myself were showering together in one stall and all soaped up, lathered up. And here comes Schuster to the stall, and right in front of Lynn. So I just said, "There he is, Red." And Red hit Schuster when I touched Lynn, and soap suds bubbles flew for 5 minutes. He smacked at Schuster. Schuster got the message and did not touch Lynn after that episode. Before this Brooklyn happening, we, Los Angeles, were playing Hollywood at Hollywood. Hollywood had us beaten by 6 or 7 runs in the ninth inning with 2 outs. Roy Joyner, left-hand pitcher for Hollywood, was pitching, and Schuster was hitting. Schuster attempted to bunt for a hit, but got thrown out at first base in the third out of the ballgame. Schuster crossed the pitcher's mound, and he said something to Joyner. I don't know what was said. And Joyner swung once, and Schuster was draped over the pitcher's rubber. Schuster was not hurt. Joyner's hand swelled, and he lost a few starting assignments from the skin fracture from Schuster's teeth and from the blow by Joyner. This accident was a publication. We went to Portland to start a 21-day road trip, and pregame practice, Schuster was out on the field, and he got ribbed by John Gill, an outfielder for Portland, who yelled, "Hey, Sabu, I hear you bit Joyner, and you have to take a saliva test." Now, your number five question. My favorite parks in the American and National Leagues were League Park in Cleveland. That's the old park where we first started to play before they moved down to the stadium. We did play part of the games in 1954. 35 at the stadium, but we played practically the whole season at League Park. Then Sportsman's Park at St. Louis, Fenway Park in Boston, and Griffith Stadium in Washington, Polo Grounds in New York, and Connie Mack Stadium in Wrigley Field. These fields had good backgrounds, and I just had success with base hits. I loved Crosley Field in Cincinnati. Fair hitting success there. Great fielding ground, and base paths offered a cushion that inspired a player and your feet and legs just to run. It just seemed to spring, and you didn't tire running on that infield. The returning players from the service naturally caused player rosters to exceed league and team personnel, so players were moved to satisfy all departments. Ben Chapman would yell to me, and he would yell, "I'm going to get you. I'm going to acquire you, get my contract." I would say, "Okay, Ben, just so you pay me." I became a Philly. However, in 1945 and 46, the Pirates were dissatisfied with many league rulings. They, the Pirates, were ready to strike and contacted other clubs to follow. We, the Phillies, entertained the movement, but Benny Bengal and I discussed the situation and player violations according to our signed contracts recorded in the Commissioner Ford Frick's office. For players to strike and not perform player duties would create a violation and penalties. Bengal suggested a pension plan. We, the Phillies, held a meeting with the manager, excluded. A plan was worked up tentatively. We left on a road trip to St. Louis first. Marty Marion, the team captain of the Cardinals, was confronted by me, and our Philly meeting was divulged to him. Marty called a clubhouse meeting immediately, and the St. Louis players were for the pension plan. This pension plan reached all teams rapidly. Ford Frick's office was contacted. All club officials were rapidly contacted. Each club appointed a player representative. Frick called a meeting of the player representatives to his office, and each representative presented their player or club grievances and a program proposal. The club owners and players agreed on the pension proposal. Clubs and players made initial agreed-upon payments in 1946. Equitable Life Insurance was selected because many major insurance companies were not prepared to indulge, negotiate, or accept such a plan. My first minutes of these meetings and formation of the pension fund is in my file to date, complete. Dixie, Fred Walker.